A few days later, Freudenberg spoke again with his ExxonMobil contact. He asked questions about how the corporation constructed its influence campaigns. He found that the ExxonMobil executive assigned to him doesn't come off at all like an ogre. He was always careful to stress the corporation's interest in a rational approach. Freudenberg asked how publication of an essay in an obscure academic journal that hardly anyone read could be of any help to a corporation as large and well-resourced as ExxonMobil. The executive admitted that such work wouldn't do much good with trial juries who tended to reach their verdicts on a non-factual basis. Once a case was appealed to panels of judges, however, the prospects to shape their thinking improved. ExxonMobil would submit a copy of the academic journal article with its legal briefs. The judges themselves don't usually read them, but often their clerks will read them, and quite a few of the clerks nowadays are pretty open to these kinds of arguments. Quite a few of them now come out of a law and economics program or something like that. It's possible to offer small amounts of support to academics who already show some tendency to express views that ExxonMobil finds congenial, the executive said. In addition, you can sponsor workshops and so forth, but that gets tricky. For one thing, once you get to that point, you pretty much have to invite both sides. Eventually, ExxonMobil submitted findings from this academic work to the United States Supreme Court to support its challenge to punitive damages arising from the Exxon Valdez spill. The decision ultimately went the corporation's way and made important new law favorable to American businesses. David Souter, the Supreme Court Justice appointed by President George H.W. Bush, joined in the majority's opinion. In a footnote, however, Souter mentioned the social science evidence submitted by ExxonMobil. "Because this research was funded in part by Exxon, we decline to rely on it," he wrote dryly. Lee Raymond turned 67 years old in August 2005. He had spent almost 42 of those years as an employee of Exxon and had served as ExxonMobil's chairman and chief executive for a dozen years, a long run at the top by the timelines of corporate America. He was an informal dean of his class. When he was at headquarters in Irving, Raymond often ate lunch in the subdued formality of the alcohol-free Rockefeller Room with his most senior lieutenants, including often the two who were competing to replace him, Ed Galante and Rex Tillerson. When he traveled out of Texas, he flew on the Challenger Global Express, designated as 100 Alpha, and he lingered in Hawaii, Augusta, and Pebble Beach to play golf and relax. He and Charlene, his wife, were building a new home in Palm Springs, California, and they would soon acquire another home near Phoenix. The Raymonds remained highly private. A luxurious, subdued retirement now awaited them, if the corporation's board of directors could persuade Raymond to take it up. Some on the board felt they had struggled since 2001 to persuade Raymond that he had to take succession and retirement seriously. Raymond felt he had done so. He had set up a contest between Tillerson and Galante over the top job, a competition that Raymond told his board was entirely genuine, a close call. "It will be a few years before you are able to figure out how good they really are," he had said when he first appointed the pair. By 2005, fearful of Raymond stalling, the board communicated softly with him that the directors felt that it was time to make a definitive move. The message they delivered was, "Gee, Lee, you're now 66. Raymond understood their worry that he might become, as he quipped privately, "the next Sandy Weill," referring to the banker who had hung on at Citigroup until he was 73, finally retiring as chairman just 2 years before the bank nearly collapsed from imprudent bets on the American mortgage market. He assured them that he was ready to go. "Believe me, I will never be the new Sandy Weill." He understood that he was plugging up career movement down the executive ranks, he told the board. He was less certain, he said, about which of the two finalists for his job the board should endorse. "Why don't you just tell us who ought to do this?" James R. Houghton, a director who served as chairman at the international glass and ceramics maker Corning Incorporated, asked at one board meeting. "I'm not sure that's my job," Raymond answered. "It's the board's job." "But you're the only guy who really knows them." "I accept that point. But I am interested in any perspectives any of you have, and you have an obligation."